Here we are. Okay, so, and some of the stuff we'll do on the blackboard just because the calculations are just a little easier in that case. To see them actually real-time done. So, we'll go to our next slide here. And so we have a little bit of review of Euclidean field theory. And what I've written up there is the Feynman propagator. And when I write all this down, I'm actually thinking right now of Lorentzian space. So we're in a Lorentzian space-time. And we're just doing a scalar field in this case. And for the moment, we can assume it's a massive scalar field. But whatever I say here, we can extend across to the massless case if we're careful about zero modes. And so most of this will be slightly formal. But we can actually make things precise. Okay, so here's our Feynman propagator. And we use a little bit of our causal structure knowledge here. And define what we mean in terms of the causal future of x and y here as far as defining our time-ordered product here. So this is our time ordering. And usually in flat space, you'll just define this in terms of light cones. But now we're in a curved background, so we actually have the notion of the causal structure, and so we can use that. And you could do the same thing in Minkowski. So it's going to agree with the usual thing. We have our in-out vacuum. And so this is just standard scalar field theory. And another remark is this is the Green's function or Green function for a wave operator. So basically, you just think of box phi equals zero type thing. And you could also put, depending how you write this, you could have your mass squared or potential, or you could have just linear terms right now, the way it's written, because this is the linear theory. Okay, now one little observation you can make is that the Euclidean Green's function, or Green function, is actually related to our Feynman propagator by this relation here. And the Euclidean Green's function satisfies Laplacian g equal, this should be delta here, some delta function. So away from the point, it's actually that. Now, the advantage of doing the Euclidean Green function is that the Laplacian's elliptic operator. In the case of Lorentzian, you have a hyperbolic operator if you have a nice space-time. And so this will actually be elliptic in it's the solution for elliptic operator, so it has a unique inverse. And elliptic equations only need one derivative to determine them. So it's very different than the case of the wave operator where you have other solutions. Now, the only assumption we are making here, there's a couple of assumptions. One, we've picked a domain to define the fields on such that you have a notion of self-adjoint, because even for elliptic operators, you'll need that technical condition. And in addition to that, you'll actually need to make sure you don't have zero modes. If you do a massless field, for example, if you just had Laplacian here I wrote it like this. Let's just write in terms of gradient. So our Laplacian of phi equals zero, or delta here, we want to invert that operator. That operator is not going to be invertible. We're not going to be able to solve for phi if we have zero modes. So if you did this on a torus, for example, where you have zero modes, that will be a problem. And so that's a slight technical difficulty. So when we do all this, a lot of the emphasis we've had is really on doing the case of the these fields, these operators like the Fock space and everything. We've done it all for the, on these space times. And there's a couple issues at hand. First, there's this picking of the time. But something we haven't talked a whole lot about is there's boundary conditions, too. So the kernel, for example, of this operator could cause you problems. That is, if there's zero modes, you have to take care of that and remove that. If you have a coupling to the curvature, if you had like a del squared phi plus r phi equals delta, if this is your operator and you have a definite, this is positive definite. So if this guy's, for example, positive definite, then there's no zero modes of that operator, and I can invert that. And so that's one way you could avoid it. Or you could avoid by hand controlling those modes. Now, we want to do thermal states. We want to talk about thermal states, temperature of black hole, temperature of De Sitter space, and some other issues. And so the way you want to do this is you can just think of an ordinary quantum mechanical system with a time-independent Hamiltonian, H. And you can define what you mean by the density matrix in that case. And the state of a thermal equilibrium, so first of all, we'll use our traditional notation, beta will be k 1 over kt. Occasionally, you'll take k to be 1 if you read literature, but I left it in just so it looks more like thermodynamics. And this is our density matrix, and I've renormalized it by the trace of this operator. Now, we can do this for any sort of nice quantum mechanical system, but there's always a warning here if we try doing this for a field theory, for example. Well, even in the quantum mechanical case, there's an issue of making these operators well-defined. But if we have a quantum mechanical system, we can usually handle that. One of the few exceptions, of course, is where you have an unbounded potential. You have, for example, like a Coulomb potential. You have to carefully treat that potential because of the blow-up at the origin. But on a nice other potentials, you don't have problems. But in field theory, this is actually more difficult to make well-defined. And that's the whole procedure of trying to make well-defined, you know, rigorous field theories. But what we'll do is we'll take this formal expression to work as is. And those issues in curved space, if there's any issue with making H well-defined, you have the same problems that you would have in flat space, at least, looking at picking domains for the operators and so forth. Okay, so we take this. Now, the thermal Feynman propagator, what we can do is we can take our time-ordered product, which we defined several slides ago. This guy. Here's the time-ordered product. We actually have it in here being used. So we can do the same setup, jumping back to where we were, and we can define what we mean by the thermal Feynman propagator. So essentially, we take our trace when we stuff in the density matrix. And rewriting that in terms of our last slide, Z is this partition function which gives us a normalization on the density matrix, and so I can just pull that factor out in front. And so that's our thermal Feynman propagator. Okay. So what I want to do is use this to actually get the temperature of a Schwarzschild black hole. And I told you we could do it all in terms of modes. Now what I'll do on the notes I give you is I'll give you some notes in which I'll work this out a little more explicitly. We don't want to do it all here, but you can follow through and you can look at some of the classic references too if you're interested and see how this is actually done. But you get a nice property off this, and this is a periodicity, and we'll see that here. So the thermal Feynman propagator is periodic in imaginary time. And this is one of the features we're going to use today. And there's sort of three examples we could probably do. We'll do two of them, and you can think about the Rindler space one. Rindler space is actually rather nice because you get the answer immediately. You don't have to write anything down. So let's see what I've done here. This is a formal manipulation. And what I've done is I've sent T to I tau in my expression. Let's see. I did this to me yesterday, too. So somehow I missed a little slide in between here. We need to know one extra fact, so I'll just write that on the board when we come to that stage. So here what I have is I'm going to send T to I tau. Now, if I'm doing quantum mechanics, you can think of this quantum mechanics would work, too. But if you're doing basic quantum field theory, quantum mechanics in Minkowski space, this is an allowed operation. In fact, you use this in trying to make Feynman... you make perturbation theory well-defined, you can put an I epsilon in. And there's an analysis where you think of taking things into the complex plane. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to formally do that. And the little missing step here is if you have an observable in Minkowski space, you can always take your observable and you can evolve it using the Hamiltonian operator. So you can actually, and we're going to use this, so if you have T plus T0 owes some observable, so it's actually an operator, you can evolve it using the Hamiltonian operator. And why don't we just do the Euclidean guy here, because we've taken it Euclidean, so this is the Euclidean, we can go tau 0 like this. And we can take that observable and hit it on both sides, the volvet. I'm just saying we can use the Heisenberg picture. So we actually use the Hamiltonian evolution operator as the operator to evolve things. So that's what I'm going to do over here. So what I'm going to do is I want to show you this is periodic. So all I do is I say T goes to I tau, and then these fields are going to be at some temperature. And what we're going to do is we're going to take x and x prime to have the same spatial coordinates, but they're going to differ in their time, this complex time coordinate, by a factor of beta h bar. So here I start off with my thermal Feynman propagator, x prime y, and then what I do is I actually just plug into the definition from the previous slide. Now, little steps I'm not giving you here that you need to fill in is you need to order up the tau 1, or the tau and tau prime here, so you're just going to move up. And so when you take this time-ordered product here, you just get this back. Okay, so you just get the first factor. And so this is just really a choice of which comes first, x, x prime. And so all I've done is just done that here. And then here, I have the same expression, so I want to come back down here. So what I have is, So here's what we really want. Just look at this guy. I've glued it twice because I wasn't sure it was going to show on that. Okay, so I've got x to x prime. And so now what I do, instead of using x prime here, I want to put x. And the way I can put x is I can actually use the Hamiltonian, the evolution operator, this unitary operator, to actually take it to the other time. So this guy here, the x prime is the same spatial coordinate. So when I write x and y in this Feynman propagator, either the thermal one or the plane one, those are space-time points. And so this is actually the same as x prime. I'm just using the evolution to do that. So I'm using the relation I written on the board there. And you can just derive that from the definition of it's the definition of the Heisenberg picture of quantum mechanics, quantum field theory. So you have this, and now I can regroup this term to get a cancellation. So that gives me this line here. Now this line here has this term. So now I've been able to move this operator across to act on y, and then I can just do this. Now, I've done these steps here by using the fact that tau prime and tau are related by a translation. So using that feature, I can actually use that with the trace, and I get this. The last step is you just reorder this, and what you then get is it's periodic. So the only thing I didn't give you here is tracking to make sure which one occurs first, move the time-ordered product back and forth like that. So it's the periodicity. If you just naively think of it without going through all the steps, if you start putting Ti tau in here, you're going to have some periodicity in that exponential type thing. And so, so we have this exponential. So these things are periodic in time. Now, you can do this for both coordinates of the Feynman thermal propagator. Yeah?
But if there is no time-like killing vector...
If there's no time-like killing vector, what do we do? So that's going to come up, and we'll see what happens. Okay. That's an excellent question. So, as just pointed out, we're really still assuming Minkowski space because I assume the validity of doing this procedure. So let's try Schwarzschild. So the question is, what about the time-like killing vectors? So Schwarzschild will get away with it a bit because there is a time-like killing vector, at least in some region of Schwarzschild. And so when I draw this picture of Schwarzschild, when I write the metric like this, the picture you should remember is the one we've been using the last few lectures, and that's our nice Penrose diagram, which you can go back and look in your notes, and I'll just write it here to illustrate that. And so this will be useful because it'll also tell us the global structure. So we should draw this guy up like this. Okay, we have the singularity along here. It looks like construction tape on the web version of the notes. On yours, it's just a little white line. And so that's the I'll just put that up a little higher in case I need to move that later. So that's our diagram. So our coordinatization we're using, basically, we're working in the DOC, as we called it yesterday, of this region. So we're really working on this partial Cauchy slice here. And so this is coordinatized there. So we're going to do the same procedure. We say, well, wait a minute. There's a static time-like killing vector. So from our lessons, we learned is, at least in that region, we have a unique vacuum and everything. But the procedure should sort of work in some sense. Now, we're a little more sophisticated in terms of space, times, and causal structure. And so we know about this Penrose diagram. And so we know there's these three other regions which we haven't even talked about in this. So we're going to be naive and just work over here. So this is almost like, in the sitter space lectures of Susskind, it's like the little causal patch. We're only going to work in this one region. So I send T to I tau, and when I do that, the metric actually becomes positive definite. Okay. So we now have a positive definite metric here. And nothing's wrong. This is actually a nice real metric. Again, this is in a chart, so this whole procedure is very heuristic right now. We're just doing a field theory type calculation. We're not worrying about all the details. And so what happens here? So the metric here has a problem. And the problem will be it still looks like it has a singularity and stuff in it. So the first thing we want to do is we want to change coordinates. So right now, to us, r equals 2m looks like it's not too good because it wasn't good in the original coordinates, and so we do some coordinate transformations. So just as we did with the extensions of Schwarzschild in the other lectures, we can do the same thing with this Euclidean. We've just changed the time coordinate. So this is our coordinate transformation. And we do this coordinate transformation, what we find is this is our new metric. So the two spheres don't do anything in that coordinatization. They stay the same. And if you go back to our diagram, the two spheres are just points in the blackboard or in our diagram. And again, I'm doing this in two dimensions or four dimensions, and the analysis is really two dimensions in nature because of the spherical symmetry. So if you look at the case of n-dimensional Schwarzschild black holes, you can do the same calculation there. It really doesn't. There's a nice paper from almost 20 years ago by Rob Myers and Malcolm Perry, where they do the n-dimensional Schwarzschild solutions. And they do both the Euclidean and the Lorentzian case. Okay, so now let's look at this metric here. Now, how does this metric look? Well, this metric, it doesn't have that problem in the denominator anymore, so that looks good. The question is that a singular metric or not? The answer is, well, it's actually a singular metric. So here we just gone back and reviewed what we did there. And it has a singularity at r equals 0, our capital R equals 0. And we can fix the singularity. The singularity here, the reason it causes problems, is capital R equals 0 gets rid of this coefficient here. And so it's nice to have, here's the metric on the two spheres, which are just the points in the blackboard. And it's nice to have that because by comparison, because we know that little r equals 0 here is also a coordinate singularity, but it's not a real singularity of any kind. So the same thing applies here. If you do a careful analysis here, what you find out is by taking tau to be periodic, you find out it's no longer singular. And it's a Riemannian, nice Riemannian manifold, with and the periodicity you need from the metric here is 8 pi m. And so we add a single point in to the metric, and we obtain our new metric and space-time. So let me just, there we go. So the original space-time over here, if you think about this, there was that throat that went through, we've drawn numerous times, that has a topology S2 cross R. So there's a couple things with the topology here. The whole Cauchy slice, that has topology S2 cross R in the Lorentzian spacetime. The partial Cauchy slice also has topology S2 cross R. So this is just a little fact to remember. And the way you can think of this is you freeze out either in this case, let's just step back here. Here, so if you freeze out the time coordinate, then you're looking at the blue surface. So you just look at from r equals infinity into r equals 2m, and what happens there is that that's actually just a piece of R3 topologically. But you're not allowed to have that point in there. That's coordinate singularity. So when you remove the point, you have R3 minus a point. And that's just a two-sphere cross R. Now, just as a side remark, it's a useful technique when doing these global things to try to figure out topologies. And so just as a remark as to what I do myself, is I usually think of Rn always as a sphere. So this makes it easier. Now, your visualization might be totally different than mine, but this does sometimes work for others, so you might want to think about this. So here's our blue surface. So we start with a point at infinity, the north pole removed. That's my R3 here. And it's foliated all the way down by two spheres. And then what I'm going to do is I'm going to extract this other point, because it's not really at zero down here. It's at R equals 2m. So I extract the sphere, but what I have between there is a product of spheres by an interval, and so that's S2 cross R. And this is some ways you can visualize. So if you want to visualize spaces to try to figure out their global topology, this is a useful technique sometimes. So think of your Rn's as really being spheres, and then it's all in the compact region, so you're doing a compactification, and then you can do that. And so the topology here of the partial Cauchy slice is S2 cross R. And then you have a static killing vector that evolves it, so that gives you the R2 cross S2. But similarly, the full Cauchy slice has exactly the same topology, because that's the throat slice. It goes back through the other side. So all you've done on your sphere is you've popped this out, or you can think of it as gluing two of these guys together. So even though the geometry is different, the topology is the same, both of the partial Cauchy slice and the Cauchy slice. Now, the geometry being different is sort of that's the whole story for the fields, but at least for thinking of the topology. The reason I emphasize this is because of what happens over here. I'm claiming here we have an S2 cross R2 topology. So when I look at the topology of Schwarzschild in this Euclideanized sector, then what I do is I'm going to take this slice here, and I'm going to cut it off. So I cut off and then I put a point in there. And so if you go through the analysis, you really work in the DOC. But it's because that DOC, the partial Cauchy slice, carries this topology that you have the same topology on an Euclideanization. Now, I'm not going to write it down again. So if you take your, I'll just refer back to it. But you take your Feynman thermal propagator, and it has a periodicity. We went through this argument. So we're assuming that Feynman thermal propagator is legitimate on the space-time, which is static. That's like an axiom. To actually do this, you would have to construct it. To actually make it precise, you'd have to do the construction of it. So if we take this as our ansatz, that this Feynman thermal propagator, my argument, still works, then what I have is KT is 1 over beta, and that's the periodicity. Remember, maybe I should go back just to remind us what it was. Let me go back. So here's our periodicity, beta times h bar. And so then what we have is, here's what we got. So inverse beta is h bar over period. So the KT, or the temperature of the Schwarzschild black hole, is h bar 8 pi km.
How did you get that period? Where did that?
Where did the period come from? Okay, so which one? The one for Schwarzschild, the period? The Schwarzschild period? Yeah. Okay, what it comes from, whoops, I don't want to go that far. Okay, what it comes from is actually looking at this coordinate here, trying to make this well-defined. And so what you have is you have the problem at r equals 0. And so the metric's singular there, because when r goes to 0, the metric sort of collapses down. The inverse of it's singular, just like in spherical coordinates. And so to make that well-defined, r equals 0 is not avoidable, but tau being periodic will actually fix that. And so if you want to do it precisely, the procedure is to do exactly what I did for extending Rindler in that funny Minkowski space yesterday. You can look at the geodesics coming in. An alternate way to do it is to really just expand the metric about that zero point, and you'll find out when you expand it, it looks like a cone. And when you take the deficit angle, to be the correct periodicity. So if you don't pick that, it won't be a manifold. And so it's from the close analysis at that point. Yeah, because the standard sticking point is when people look at it, that it's not exactly clear why it's periodic. Okay. Okay, so this gives our periodicity. So as long as we have this thermal Feynman propagator, then all we need to do is do this Euclideanization of the metric, and it'll give us a temperature. So the question is, you know, what happens in general there? So let's look at this sitter here. So do the de-sitter. Sure.
If I'm, say, I'm on my Corby slice, I can start with any state I want. Like, I could start with a state with a different temperature. So what would happen then?
So you're going to have inconsistency. So what we've done so far, okay, so what we've done so far is it's only geometrical. And it's based on the periodicity of this propagator. So what we're assuming is that we can take the Lorentzian fields into the Euclidean. So under that assumption, we're forced into this periodicity. So now you can ask, well, what if I do other things? And so to do that, you have to actually do the calculations. And typically, at least my experience has been, you calculate both Lorentzian and Euclidean answers and look at them. And at some stage, you can then decide if you can go ahead and just do the Riemannian or the Euclidean calculations. I'll mention what happens in the case of de Sitter, which does give you sort of a strange behavior. Maybe that'll sort of show you a little bit more of how this sort of goes bad. So there's the thing we have to remember, there's more than one vacuum to pick here. So when I pick the particular one, if I did my Euclidean fields now on this Riemannian background, what I would get is I would get the Hartle-Hawking vacuum for this case. And there's more than that. There's the Bunch-Davies vacuum, so there's more than that vacuum to pick. And so this one gives me one particular one, and so I can have other things happen. And when you study your fields, they will have different behaviors. So de Sitter is sort of a nice example because it also violates the question which was asked when I first start doing it, what if you don't have a time-like killing vector? So this one is nice because it does have a time-like killing vector in other coordinates, and you can ask what happens then. Okay, so here's de Sitter space, time, and this is written in the global coordinates. And what happens here is just a few comments. I want to tell you a little bit about the vacuum structure here. This is the group that's the de Sitter group, which is an invariant under. And G is just the identity component. And you can break it up into other parts, as you can do just for the ordinary rotation group in four dimensions. For example, it's usually easier to think of compact groups. So if you think of O4, O4 is really SU2 cross SU2 mod the common -1, -1 term from each factor. And locally, as a Lie algebra, it's SO3, which is the same as SU2. But the global group structure is really SU2 cross SU2 mod a Z2. And the way you can get, and that's the SO4 part, but to get the O4, you include the orientation reversing diffeos, or the discrete diffeos, or isometries there, not diffeomorphisms, but isometries. So when you do de Sitter, you can do the same thing. This is the identity component of it. It has four components total, so three other disconnected components. So four disconnected components here. And you have time reversal, which is a discrete symmetry. And you have the spatial reflection, so forth. And you can have spatial reflection time symmetries combined. And so to build these other groups, all you do is you take your elements in the identity component and act them on them by discrete symmetry. That gives you the other component. Each component is sort of the same topological space. They're copies of each other, and you get from one to the other by acting on with a discrete symmetry. So this has a lot of symmetry. So let's talk a little bit about the sort of vacuum in that here. You can also do Lorentzian field theory calculations. And so if you take this as our example, we're going to come back and we'll try this Euclidean. And this one's one that's really nice to sort of work out on the board because you can actually see how the Euclideanization works. So what I'm going to do is this will be the Lorentzian calculation here. So here I take a symmetric two-point function, and we take it in this vacuum state here. And this is just basically, instead of using time-ordered product, I use the anti-commutator. And I could take the commutator version. I can. There's a bunch of different Green's functions to pick. And each one may give me different physics, and I have to analyze. So it's just like the case of the Rindler space. These choices of the Green's function is the same as picking the actual, you know, basis, because a different G, I can write these different ways. And what you can do is you can define this now, your X and Y, you need to define this in terms of the distance if you think of the traditional type thing. So this is the one with the anti-commutator, it's explicitly written out. Here's my vacuum states. And this distance is the geodesic distance between the points X and Y. And so then I write out my operator, so this is actually, now it's, you know, I've Euclidianized, and so I get my general solution. And this is the actual Green's function here, the core two-point function. And, I mean, it's not very transparent. It's just written out so you realize you can actually solve this. And F here, F21, is your hypergeometric function. And you only have a second-order ODE, you have to remember. And so what's going to happen, as in the Schwarzschild case and all the other ones, you have nice symmetries. And so the coordinate, the angular variables get pulled away, and the radial coordinates are really all you solve for in the end. And so most of these problems that where you can write down the solution, like they're spherically symmetric, they will reduce to doing a calculation, just a classical second-order ODE. Now, it doesn't mean the problem is easy. I mean, saying the function, the solution is a hypergeometric function of some particular type may not be totally transparent either. You don't know, you know, what's the range of these parameters and stuff. And this will have, when you do the pole analysis, you either get these first or second factor will have the, so one of the factors will actually have a simple pole when you do the analysis. These are the roots. Oops. What? Okay, so, yeah, I just want to do one more thing with this guy. But somehow. Okay, now what happens here, the important point here, is there's a lot of talk about the so-called alpha vacuum. And so what's going to happen here is you get a different choice for each choice of alpha. You get a solution. And so it means you don't have a unique answer. Now alpha here, we're working in four-dimensional Minkowski space, so alpha is 1 over the Hubble constant. Or alpha is what? Alpha squared is like 3 over lambda type thing, the cosmological constant. So that, so different choices, you get different answers. And so this is not going to be unique. You know, so you have some different behavior.
Excuse me, what is psi?
The factor in front of
lambda.
This here?
Yes.
That's a coupling parameter in the how you couple the field. Let's see, I had it. I think I had it in the slide the other day. It's the basically the coupling in how you're going to couple your field in. It's a parameter in the theory. Yeah. And yeah, so these are the parameters. This is some coupling to the cosmological constant. So this is for the massive scalar field. And so you can. You typically will put the parameter, and then you can pick different values for that parameter also. Okay, so here is, this is the Green's function worked out, and this is not the thermal one, but it's one of the, you know, things. It's just to show you the vacuum's not unique. And let me just show you what you can do with this example here. And this one's actually rather nice case to work out. So this one, I want to just work it out and see what happens. Okay, so the thing we want to look at here is the metric we want to do our continuation. So here's ds squared minus dt squared, and we have plus alpha squared. And remember, alpha is 1 over the cosmological constant squared, so, or 1 over a cosmological constant, alpha is. So we have this cosh. And then we have the three-sphere metric. And I'll just simplify that by just saying that's the metric on the three-sphere. We have that guy sitting there. Now, you can do the you can do this calculation as a thermal calculation. So you can actually go T goes to I tau here and see what happens. Now, this is totally formal at this stage because the point is, this does not have a time-like killing vector. I could write it in the other chart that we saw, we've seen the other day. I can write it in that chart and put the time-like killing vector in, but that won't be the global slice. So let's see what happens if we do the global slice here. Okay, so if you put this in the first term, then you get ds squared is actually d tau squared plus alpha squared cosh squared of I tau alpha, metric of the three-sphere. Now, what we recall from calculus, or if you may have learned cosh before that, but that the cosh of I tau is the cosine of tau, just using Euler's identity, which we use all the time in physics. So that means this is actually now a totally real metric. So the final Euclideanization is d tau squared plus alpha squared cosine squared tau over alpha d t or d cubed like that. Okay. Okay, so that's our metric right here. Now the question is, what does that represent? What's that a metric on? So now what you need to do, let me just switch these guys here. This is actually always hard. It's the easiest to always do this on the blackboard, I realized. So there's our metric. And the thing to do is think of the original metric there. So think of the metric at the top, which is the Lorentzian one. Let's look at what that looks like. So that guy looks like a tachyonic hyperboloid sitting inside five-dimensional Minkowski space, and you cut it, or you have this constraint. And then you cut this to get the time evolution there. You're cutting it with planes. And so each one of these planes here is actually a three-sphere when it cuts the hyperboloid. And the factor in front just causes these guys to expand outward like this. And as you go to the back, or reverse in time, go to the past, these are expanding outward. So you got your minimum one here at the center, and that's when t is equal to 0. And that's when your cosh has got a value of 1. So the size scale there is set by alpha squared. Okay? So what's going to happen? This is the blue metric. Let's do the orange guy now, the Euclidean metric. Okay, so now here's S3. So we have the same setup. Okay, so when we look at that setup, what's going to happen? Well, we now have a cosine there. So as tau increases at the cosine, we still start, these both start off, they have the same Riemannian metric. That is, that Cauchy slice and our Riemannian slice, whatever that means, has exactly the same metric. And when we start pushing this forward, now, this is the time direction here. We don't want to mix colors. Then, as we push this guy forward in tau, this is going to collapse inward. And same thing here. Okay. And what's going to happen is, in some finite time, this is going to go to 0. So this basically does this. It's not quite that sort of oblate. Let me just resketch it now that we sort of argued what it looks like. And what it looks like is this. And that's tau, and tau to the past. So those are our two pictures. This is, put an E on there just like I did in the Schwarzschild diagram, and the blue guy will acquire just a DS squared, or Lorentzian guy. That's sort of our preferred picture. Okay, so now, here's our guy. So what is this guy? Well, the topology of both these spaces is identical. Right? This guy has topology S3. Let's keep that blue. So this has topology S3. And you just have a bunch of S3s, so they foliate up, so that's S3 cross R. This guy is S3. It's S3, it's S3 both ways. So this guy is S3 cross R. Okay, so they both have the same topology. But now, when we get to some value of tau, this cosine is periodic. So if we have the cosine equals pi over 2 times alpha, or some multiple of 90 degrees, basically, we're going to pass through zeros. So the volume's decreasing, and this will actually happen when tau at the top here, this point, is tau equals pi over 2 alpha. Okay. And so we started at tau equals 0, and that's sort of our maximum range, and you have the same thing in the past. But what happens at this point? Well, we have the same problem we had for Schwarzschild. At this point here, we have basically that factor multiplying the 3-sphere goes to 0, so that's a singularity in the metric. So what we need to do to carefully analyze this, this is the whole reason for talking about the analysis in the beginning, is we actually need to think about the geodesics going into that point. And when you carefully analyze it, it's not singular at all. In fact, if you know about higher dimensional geometry, you would say, oh, that's a 4-sphere. And so you're allowed to attach two points. So you can put this point in, so you put the north and south poles back in. And the final topology, when you complete it, is S4 with a round metric. Okay? And now you've acquired a period. You can get your period off here. And you can plug it back into the Feynman propagator formula, the thermal propagator. And so what this tells you is you actually have a temperature associated with the space-time. The temperature here, alpha, remember, is 1 over h bar, or 1 over, alpha is 1 over h. And so it's related basically to the Hubble constant, or you can relate that to alpha squared is 3 over lambda, or something like that. Okay, so basically you see this thermal radiation also in De Sitter, formally, I'd say. Okay, now it's a formal argument only because what? I've assumed this thermal Feynman propagator makes sense, and I've actually gone through just the Euclideanization of it. Okay, but the question is what happens in general then? And the other thing is how do we make sense of this? And so what you can then do is you can go through calculations like this one into all the details, and you get the same answer. The other thing you can do is you can do the Euclidean field theory and Lorentzian field theory and compare the two. So if you take the this procedure, this does make sense even though it's not a static slice. Now, there's a natural question. In the lectures on De Sitter, we heard about the static slicing of De Sitter. And let me just remind you, I believe I have that one. Let's just go way back to my static slice, since I didn't have it in today's. Let's see. Da-da-da. Let's see. So we... Yeah, so here's the all the different... Here's a set of slicings of De Sitter. And These are some of the slicings. And here's our static slice. This one looks very much like Schwarzschild. Now the question is, what happens if you do the same procedure to this guy? Now, in the case here, this was really nice. The Euclideanization worked very nicely geometrically, but what about the field theory calculation? And so the field theory calculation works well here too, even though you have this time, if you're using that Cauchy slice. So in this field theory calculation, you're using the Lorentzian Cauchy slice. What happens if you use this guy? Well, you can just repeat the same procedure we did for Schwarzschild. Pick your same coordinates. You get a periodicity again in the time coordinate, or in the, in the time coordinate, because again, you're going to have r going to the coefficient in front goes to zero, so you have to make sense of that. So you're going to get the same temperature, but what happens if you do the field theory calculation? What you'll find is if you do the field theory calculation in this chart, the vacuum you pick that goes with the thermal, this thermal procedure, thermal state, will actually have a divergent stress energy tensor on the horizon. So the stress energy itself will actually diverge in this guy. And so this is one of the problems you start to encounter. The question is, which vacuum do you pick? In the other slide where I actually had the anti-commutator two-point function, or Green's function, that one actually has this alpha vacuum where you can pick all these different vacuum states. You got all these parameters in the theory. Which do you pick? And so, again, you're forced into different regimes in which you have to decide. It's the same thing. You have Bunch-Davies vacuum, you have Hartle-Hawking, you have fine, you know. So there's no unique vacuum caused by the geometry. So this one looks very nice as a Schwarzschild solution, but actually has a very sick stress energy tensor. So that's one of the problems you encounter there. Yeah?
Alpha and lambda related?
Yeah. Alpha is, three over lambda. It's just convenient, so then you don't have to write. It depends on the dimension, too, I think, the three. That's the relation there. So it's just a convenient choice. So this tells you some of the problems you have. Now let me mention, we had that one other example. So here's the static chart. Again, just to review what will happen in this case. You can do your thermal analysis on this and try it. And like I said, what's going to happen is when you look at the horizon in these guys, the stress energy tensor will actually blow up there when you take vacuum expectation values of that. You can also go back and we have this RP3 de Sitter, space-time. And this is the partial Cauchy slice for RP3 de Sitter. So what is the RP3 de Sitter? Well, it's actually on the board here, written without coordinate restrictions. So the RP3 Schwarzschild, this is just the de Sitter. We can do the Schwarzschild one too. What we do is we take our S3 here, and we take out Z2. So we do the same thing over here. And the way we do this is just a point x goes to minus x within the 3 sphere. So it's just the projective space defined on that. And what happens then is this slice here is no longer a 3 sphere, but an RP3 all the way up. And so that's a nice cosmology. The isometry group of that cosmology, the spatial isometries of a 3 sphere, if we take the orientation reversing ones, is SO4. And the isometry group of RP3 is actually SO3 cross SO3. You lose one discrete isometry. And the discrete isometry you lose is the one you used right here to define the space. That doesn't do anything. It's not there anymore. So this actually has six-dimensional isometry groups, so it has maximum symmetry. In fact, RP3 is a Lie group itself. You know, it's just the rotation group in three dimensions. So it's a very nice symmetric space. So it doesn't. There's nothing that really prohibits it from being a cosmological solution. So it's a very nice cosmological solution. And its evolution looks exactly the same, except, you know, person over here and person over here, these have been identified across. So you can do the same thing over here. So this is one of the problems with the Euclideanization. And if you take this point to this point over here, well, you just got RP3 again. Now you continually take that, push that up. And so the metric here is exactly the same as the local form, but the problem you have is when you get to the North and South Pole. Well, when you go to the North Pole here, if you carefully look at those spherical coordinates, they're going bad at the North Pole. And so as you come in, these three spheres are collapsing down to points, but they're nicely parameterized. When you come up here, you don't have three spheres collapsing down to points, but you actually have RP3s coming into points. And same thing in the south hemisphere. So this thing, the topology over here, is not like RP4. It's not like the, you know, just going, you just take the identification act on S4. It doesn't act properly on S4 to give you RP4. What it is the topology of this is actually a conifold. You have two non-manifold points in this particular space-time, or this Riemannian manifold. And so the question is what you do there. If you do the thermal calculations, you can do it in the Lorentzian, you can just repeat all the stuff I told you about with the Green's functions. If you actually do the Lorentzian calculation, this guy will have the obvious temperature you get from the Sitter case. You have the same periodicity again. And so that part carries over. The actual modes to construct the Green's function on this guy, or this guy, you just use the S3 modes, which are invariant under this symmetry. And so you have a complete expansion. And in that case, you get the correct answer if you treat this to actually be a conifold and not a manifold. Okay. So to sort of go back and summarize some of the ideas on Euclidean field theory, what you're doing is you do this formal procedure ascending t to I tau. Now, I didn't do all these complicated examples, which you can do. I'll include some of these in the notes, but they're, you know, it's just a bunch of formulas in some sense. But you're just going to send one coordinate to another coordinate through this complexification, but that doesn't always work. This example is a nice example here where you do the RP3 guy, which I have over here. This is a static chart of it. And it's nice in the sense that you can do the complete calculation on it. You get the correct answer provided you add these extra points. So 20 years ago, when people, even longer, 25 years ago, when people did Euclidean field theory in curved space, it was believed that the Euclidean way of doing things is the correct, you know, it's the ultimate answer kind of thing. But these examples were always avoided. They usually did no identifications. So once you start doing identifications, and when you do non-static metrics, obviously, you start to have problems. Okay. So I would say a good rule on doing any of these is to actually, if you do a Euclidean calculation, you should always check the Lorentzian, or have some Lorentzian check on your answer. Okay. Some of the other things you can do which are rather strange is if you just do complex coordinate transformations, you're allowed to actually, you can convert Schwarzschild metric into Kerr through an elaborate set of complex coordinate transformations. And so that is not a very physical statement because you're going from a black hole which has angular momentum to one which has none, or vice versa, depending which way you take your transformation. So this Euclidean method, it's nice to think of sending, you know, t to I tau, but I would warn you that you should carefully make sure there's some physical basis for doing that. So typically where it works is when you have a static case, you have a highly symmetrical case, but in the general case it's not going to work. Okay. To summarize, so what we really looked at is we looked at the quantum fields in curved space, just the basics of it. We didn't really talk about interacting fields. The case, the de Sitter, some of the stuff we did in the Sitter, you can actually put interacting fields on there, polynomial, you know, 5-4 type fields, and ask questions about that. And you can do the interacting theory. People have done gauge theories on curved space, and you can do these calculations. But again, you're very restricted to the types of space-times you can apply the techniques to. One of the most shocking results was probably from 1980, where, just as a last remark, you can actually look at... The back reaction calculation. And there's a paper in 1980 by Gary Horowitz which sort of surprised some people. And what you do is you look at your Einstein tensor. So this is just a shorthand for the Ricci curvature plus the other. And you can actually go and ask yourself, what's the back reaction? So this, we didn't talk about, this actually has a lot of different aspects. And so if you read Burrell and Davies, the reference sort of for this introductory course, this is one of the goals, is we have the machinery now to actually talk about this. That is, we know how to define vacuum, we know how to define our states. What we mean by this expectation value is you have some quantum fields coupled to gravity. So you have your quantum fields on a curved background. And you'll want to take the expectation value of the stress energy tensor for those fields. And so this will be some sort of states, maybe the vacuum state, and you worry how you actually set this up. And then you calculate how this affects the Einstein tensor. So you have coupled classical. What we've done is we fixed the background. And we haven't worried about the fields actually feeding back in as sources. So when you do the back reaction calculation, everyone's seen in string theory how you can get a conformal anomaly. So you can get conformal anomalies for conformally invariant theories and all the sort of standard type things. But you can ask, how does this change the geometry? And typically, you'll get exponential growth from that. But the case Gary looked at is he looked at the case of Minkowski space-time. And he put in the back reaction. And what he found out is Minkowski space-time was unstable under these conditions. And so that was a surprising result, because you get this instability in it. And what was believed at the time, and I think still is sort of, how do you explain this away? The point is, the case he's looking at, he's beyond the regime in which the approximation of doing this back reaction or putting this vacuum expectation value back in here is actually valid. It's no longer legitimate at that point. So this is another thing you have to be careful about, is how far, if you do a back reaction calculation or if you do the quantum fields in curved space-time, at what stage does it affect the geometry to some point where you don't get the right answers anymore? So this is just another warning in the thing. Okay, so these are sort of the topics of quantum fields and curved space. And so I guess it's good. We can just see if you have any last questions. I'll be around next week, so if you think of any other questions, always. I'm on campus, so I'll be coming to the talks and that. So if you want to ask other questions outside the class, you're welcome to do that too. Okay, thanks. Why should one do that? Or? Well, part of the goal was to really understand. I mean, we have the black hole. I mean, there's a lot more to the black hole than we said. And I think most of you actually know all the points. You don't know, maybe you haven't seen all the technical points for that. But with the black hole, you have the evaporation. And so one of the goals is, what happens when you have the particle production around the black hole, or you have this idea that the black hole actually evaporates? Because if it has a temperature T, I didn't write down the distribution. I'll probably put it in the final notes. But there's, it has a Planckian distribution. It's radiating energy. That energy has to come from somewhere. You can actually get a rate. And what you find is the smaller the black hole, the hotter, the faster it radiates. And so one of the goals with putting the back reaction is, what kind of effects do you have there? The other type of calculations which people are doing now with doing back reaction calculations. So I guess the standard physical model where you've seen this done in is electromagnetism. Or you see this in two places. You do get sort of nonsensical answers when you look at radiating charges in electromagnetism. But this is actually important, say, for a hydrogen atom. Why is the hydrogen atom unstable? Or why is it stable, is what I want to say. Because classically, it should radiate away and spiral in. And so usually people say quantum mechanics fixes that. And the reason we know it fixes is it gives us quantized orbits. Even if you think of modern quantum mechanics, not the Bohr model, but actually just solving Schrodinger's equation, you get quantized energies. And then people leave it at that and say, that fixes the orbit problem. But it still didn't answer the question of the radiation. So where you do the semi-classical or back reaction calculation is when you put the electromagnetic field in as a set of modes coupling in. You haven't really done QED or the field theory. and you're doing that approximation, that's sort of a hand-picked thing, but that's not going to work for all values. So some set of parameters for which that's good. But if you do something like Lamb shift in the hydrogen atom, you find out that you need QED to get the correct correction there. So it's the same kind of, there was a lot of this kind of idea, I think. I used to talk to, I was a student where Leonard Parker is, so I'd actually talk to him a lot. He wasn't my advisor, but I'd actually ask him questions. So a lot of times, you know, he's one of the people that first start looking at these back reactions in cosmologies, and he was interested in like particle production and that, to actually do things with cosmologies. And also, you know, originally people did think of these models of the like atomic things. And so you expect it to sort of work and give you some sensible answers. But, you know, I'm not saying it doesn't give, there are regimes in which it does work, but you have to be careful. There's also things like, the other interest is the singularity theorems. Can you use this to actually avoid a singularity in your space-time? That was another interest. Because the singularity theorems follow from that Ray-Schertihy equation I have. You can just go through and you basically get caustics in the geodesics because of the negative sign on there when you have energy. So one idea is, when you do the quantum fields, will the expectation values, should be the correct energy, will they have you know, negative energy? And that question's never been totally answered yet. In two dimensions, you know that all quantum fields have average null energy, positive. But the higher dimensional cases aren't open. There's a conjecture even that if you have negative energy, then the small violations of negative energy charge you interest. You have to repay with large amounts of positive to compensate for that. So there's all these little, you know, so there is some motivation for the back reaction in doing that. But yeah, any other questions?
I don't see how the mood expansion method, the Lorentzian method, takes care of energy conservation. When a black hole evaporates.
Oh, yeah, when the black hole evaporates, you're in trouble. I mean. Yeah, I mean, when you do the Lorentzian, when you do Lorentzian calculation, let me give you the quick answer. You have to have some evolution of. Even if you're doing the quantum field theory, you're doing a Cauchy problem in the quantum field theory. So you need the space-time to actually be globally hyperbolic. But when you evaporate, you can just make the Penrose diagram. I won't bother doing it. But you can make the Penrose diagram of the black hole and then just straighten the R equals 2m horizon out to a straight line. It goes back to Minkowski. When the black hole pops or evaporates away, you violate the global hyperbolicity, or they usually say it's a violation of cosmic censorship. So it means your evolution, the operators, that doesn't make sense anymore. And so you're not going to be able to do you don't know what to do, but the classical physics has gone pretty bad, too, on the geometry level. So you're absolutely right. I mean, and this is always these statements about unitarity violations, and string theory doesn't have this. You can argue different things there. Yeah. So you'll have that problem, absolutely. So this is like to get started, right? I mean, but this has all changed, right? I mean, what people tried to do 20 years ago with this is totally different than what's being done now. Using it for a different problem, but it's the same machinery.